I'm Bonnie Lin, Director of the China Power Project and Senior Fellow for Asian Security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In this episode of the China Power Podcast, we're discussing China's growing nuclear capabilities. How is China modernizing its nuclear arsenal, and what is driving those changes? What are the implications of China's nuclear expansion, and how should the United States incorporate China into arms control negotiations? Joining us for this discussion are David Logan and Phil Saunders, who recently co-authored a new report titled Discerning the Drivers of China's Nuclear Force Development, Models, Indicators, and Data. David is an assistant professor of security studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He previously studied at the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval War College and conducted research for the Center for the Study of Chinese Military Affairs at the National Defense University, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, and the Office of Net Assessment. His research focuses on nuclear weapons, arms control, deterrence, and the U.S.-China security relationship. Phil is a director of the Center for the Study of Chinese Military Affairs at the National Defense University. He previously worked at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, where he served as director of the East Asia Non-Proliferation Program and taught courses on Chinese politics, Chinese foreign policy, and East Asian security. He has conducted research and consulted on East Asian security issues as well as Asia policy. David and Phil, thank you for joining us today.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
China has been rapidly building up and modernizing its nuclear forces in recent years. David, from your perspective, what are the key ways China is doing so?
Sure. I think we can think about China's ongoing nuclear modernization and expansion as falling into four different dimensions. So the first dimension, and the one that usually receives the most significant attention in the news, is an ongoing increase in the size of China's nuclear warhead stockpile. Just over a decade ago, China was assessed to have fewer than 200 operational warheads. And today, the Defense Department estimates that China possesses perhaps just over 400 bombs, and that this number could climb to 1,000 warheads by 2031. And that if China continues on its current trajectory, that it would possess 1,500 warheads by 2035, which is roughly the number of warheads that the United States and Russia are limited to deploying under the New START agreement. We've also seen a significant expansion in the forces operating China's nuclear weapons. We've seen an increase in the number of brigades, for example, under the Rocket Force, growing from 29 to perhaps more than 40 in just the last few years, and has received significant media attention. China's constructing more than 300 new ICBM silos. The second dimension along which China is improving its nuclear forces is increasing their diversity. And we can see this both across the military services, but also an increasing number of delivery vehicles within those military services. So previously, the Rocket Force really was the only element of the PLA that had a credible nuclear force. But today, China fields a fleet of at least a half dozen nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines. We believe that some of them are now equipped with the longer-range JL-3 submarine-launched ballistic missile, which would allow China's submarines to target the continental United States without leaving Chinese waters, which is a significant development. The PLA Air Force has been reassigned a nuclear mission, and China is working on a next-generation strategic bomber. So with these developments, the latest DoD report on the Chinese military now assesses that for the first time, China has a viable nuclear triad of delivery systems dispersed across land, sea, and air forces. The third dimension that we're seeing an increase in capabilities is the quality of the nuclear forces that China operates. These forces, especially the land-based forces, are increasingly accurate. They are more mobile, including for some of them, the ability to go off-road, which increases the difficulty of tracking them and increases their survivability. And we also have some nuclear-capable systems that are equipped with MIRV technology, so they can launch multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, which provides more upload capability for China's strategic nuclear delivery vehicles. China's also working on some of the supporting infrastructure related to its nuclear capabilities. This includes an early warning system consisting of both remote sensing satellites and ground-based radars, although I don't think that that will come to maturity for at least several years. And China's also working on some of these more exotic nuclear-relevant capabilities, like a hypersonic glide vehicle and fractional orbital bombardment system. Finally, the fourth dimension that we're seeing a significant increase along, we have somewhat less, I think, firm open source evidence of changes on this dimension, but we do have evidence, is hints of operational shifts in how China is operating its nuclear forces. So to go back again to the latest DoD report on the PLA, and I'm going to quote here, it reads, quote, although the PRC almost certainly keeps the majority of its nuclear forces on a peacetime status, nuclear and conventional rocket force brigades conduct combat readiness duty and high alert duty. That's the end of the quote. This sort of suggests that some rocket force units are moving to a higher level of alert, which we assume includes the ability to launch on shorter notice. And so what we see across these four dimensions is significant evidence that the size, the structure, the capabilities, and the operations of China's nuclear forces are changing, and they're all increasing. But while we have very good evidence of these shifts in hardware and to a certain extent operations, we have very little good evidence about why these changes are taking place. And China has not been very transparent about its nuclear forces in the past, but it's at least provided a baseline of information in terms of why it possesses nuclear weapons, the missions that they're meant to serve, and at least general principles that guide the development of those nuclear forces. But we've had, to my knowledge, no official statement about the ongoing buildup, what its drivers are, what its goals are, what the endpoint is. And we even see Chinese officials denying that some elements of the buildup are happening. And Chinese experts outside the government that I've spoken to also talk about how the Chinese strategic community is increasingly in the dark. So we have this growing disconnect between China's historic limited view of nuclear weapons and expanding capabilities. And what Phil and I wanted to do in this report was to take a more systematic approach to thinking about what are the potential competing explanations that could explain the ongoing buildup and modernization, and which ones have the best evidence to support them.
Given everything you've described in terms of what China is doing, would you say that China is across the board in terms of its nuclear modernization, trying to go as rapidly as possible, particularly on the capability side?
That's a great question. Historically, China has been very slow both to develop and to field some of its nuclear relevant systems. We can see this in a number of different areas. So one is China has adopted something of a technology reserve model when it comes to its nuclear and strategic forces. And so what this means is that China will often develop technologies that are relevant for these forces, but there'll be a lag between successful development and actual deployment. So to take the example of MIRVs that I mentioned earlier, these multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, China was believed to have the ability to deploy MIRVs perhaps as early as the early 1990s when it launched multiple satellites into different orbits with the same rocket launch. But it wasn't until 2015 that the U.S. Defense Department assessed that China had actually deployed MIRV technology onto its ICBMs. Similarly, we have evidence that China tested a neutron bomb, which is often believed to be the foundation for low-yield nuclear warhead designs in the 1980s. But as far as we can tell from the open source, China has chosen not to deploy these. So historically, China's been very slow to develop these capabilities. As to the recent shift, we're in the middle of it, so I think it's a little bit hard to evaluate the pace. Certainly, the pace has been significant compared to where China was previously, but part of that is also because Chinese nuclear capabilities had been so small and immature in the past. So even a doubling of China's warhead stockpile amounts to an increase of roughly 200 warheads. But I will say that one of the things that we try to do in the report is to look at leading indicators. So what are data points that will move today that could help us predict shifts in the future? And I would encourage some of the listeners, if they want a deep dive, to go into the appendix on this. And one of the things that we look at is the number of enrollments in Rocket Force professional military education institutes. And we see a relatively significant spike in students in that institute who are studying nuclear relevant subjects. But that number has also decreased this past year, although it's at a higher level than it had been over the past decade or so. So that may not be a very satisfying answer. I think in some ways it may be early to tell, but I'm also happy to defer to Phil if he has thoughts.
In my view, we've seen a significant acceleration of their force development. So it's moving a lot faster than it was before. I'm not sure I would characterize it as a crash program or saying that they're going as fast as possible in every dimension of it, because I think there's some areas where we don't see much happening, but we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Phil, let me turn to you next. One of the areas of your report that I thought was very important was the six different models that your report identifies, lays out, and then tests to explain why China is modernizing its nuclear program at the pace that it is. Could you share with us how you came up with these six different models? And what do each of these models show in terms of why China wants to expand its nuclear program?
We looked at what was out there in the literature and what were people arguing that might be rationales for what China is trying to do. So kind of the broad literature on nuclear weapons development and the China-specific literature. And then we tried to flesh out these models, and I'll talk in a moment about the six we chose to focus on, with an eye to making them a little bit distinct from each other, and then identifying indicators that would tell us, is there evidence for this or not? And of course, as good methodology, we came up with all of our indicators first in conjunction with the models, and then we went out and looked what the evidence had to tell us about it. But at the end of the day, we came up with six models, and I'll describe them each briefly. One that we looked at is the Secure Second Strike model. This is a traditional way of understanding China's nuclear force development. It says the goal is to have a secure nuclear deterrent in the face of advancing adversary capabilities. So how do you get and maintain a secure second strike? And in this model, actual and projected increases in U.S. offensive and defensive capabilities would increase the nuclear force requirements for a survivable deterrent. So that's the dynamic here, is what does it take to have and maintain a secure second strike in an atmosphere where U.S. missile defenses are changing, U.S. nuclear capabilities are changing, U.S. conventional strike is changing, and the dynamic is how much is enough for China to be confident in a secure second strike. So that's probably the most traditional model. That sometimes has been called a minimal deterrent, but I think as we formulated it, it's responsive to what potential adversaries are doing. The second model is probably the most unique. We call it the nuclear shield model, and it's kind of a stronger version of the secure second strike. But the way we think about it is the goal of a nuclear deterrent is not just to deter strategic nuclear attacks, but to sort of stretch those nuclear capabilities to deter adversary limited use of theater nuclear weapons and conventional military intervention in order to gain freedom of action, particularly in a conflict over Taiwan. So this model draws on the logic of the stability-instability paradox, that if you have stability at the strategic nuclear level, that may actually enable conventional war. And so this model says, well, maybe that's what China's trying to do, create a nuclear stalemate that will let them fight and win a conventional war over Taiwan. So that's a little bit of a different formulation than you usually see. A third model focuses on great power status. And this says that nuclear weapons are a source of international power and status. And maybe what this is about is China trying to no longer have a lean and effective small deterrent, but want a nuclear force that's more similar to the U.S. and Russian forces for reasons of prestige and status. And so this implies a larger, more technologically advanced nuclear force. And there is some direct evidence for this. We do see PLA writings that talk about the need to build a nuclear force that's commensurate with China's international status. But what's distinct about this is it's the numbers and technology that matter for status, not really the military applications of nuclear warheads and nuclear weapons. The fourth model we looked at is we call the theater deterrence model. And this focuses on the potential for using nuclear weapons in a limited conflict, either to try to deter adversary use of nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, theater nuclear weapons on the battlefield, or potentially for China to use them itself as a military tool. And so the logic here is that nuclear war can be contained. That's different from how China's traditionally thought about this. And that there can be military value in tactical nuclear weapons, either for deterrence purposes or coercive purposes. And so that implies a shift to the theater and the battlefield level rather than the strategic level, which would be a big change for China. The fifth model we looked at focuses on bureaucratic politics, and it sees the outcome of China's nuclear force development as the result of bargaining between the different bureaucratic actors involved in nuclear policy. That's the civilian political leaders who have the last say, but it's also the different military services, the nuclear weapons establishment, and civilian strategists. And it sees an interplay between these different actors that produces the policy. And that might not necessarily be as strategic or as rational as possible. So this kind of model would pretty easily explain the fact that China is shifting toward a triad, and it would say that the Navy and the Air Force want to get into the nuclear business and advocated for it, and that's why you see it. That doesn't necessarily mean a nuclear triad makes strategic sense for China, but a bureaucratic politics model, things don't have to make strategic sense. That's not how they're produced. And then finally, the last model we looked at was the nuclear superiority model, which sees a China that's trying to achieve quantitative and qualitative dominance over other nuclear weapon states. This is a China that really does want to be number one in nuclear weapons, either at the regional level compared to regional adversaries like India, or at the global level compared to the United States and Russia. This is a very different view of nuclear weapons, that there are very important political and military benefits from superiority, that that's something desirable and to be sought. And so that's something that would be very different from traditional thinking. So that's what we laid out as the models. And what we tried to do in the study was test this against today's China nuclear force structure, the nuclear forces that are projected for about a decade from now, and then to look at it, a variety of other capabilities and indicators which aren't nuclear forces themselves, but would give clues as to which of these models best explains what's going on.
Of these six models that you developed, did you hypothesize that one or more of these models would be more aligned with where China is now or where China could be heading?
Well, if we look at this historically, China's policy has been focused on secure second strike. So we thought that was a model that has been used to explain their nuclear decisions in the past, and likely was still accurate. There has been debates among the Chinese military about nuclear war fighting. And so we thought it would be worth taking a look whether the theater deterrence model had support, if we saw changes in the Chinese nuclear forces and capabilities that were supporting that. Mainly because this is something the PLA's periodically argued about and sometimes advocated for, but the civilians have always rejected the notion of changing doctrine. So I don't know that we expected that one, but given that there were known advocates in China for it, that seemed worth taking a close look at. And then finally, the bureaucratic politics model. At this point, we have various memoirs and other sources that go into the early days of the Chinese nuclear weapons program. And it's pretty evident that bureaucratic actors, including nuclear weapons scientists and the nuclear weapons establishment, had a pretty strong influence over the course of development of China's nuclear program, and the military had a relatively modest one. So that's a model that explains some things pretty well in the past, and we thought it was worth a look. Does it still have explanatory power today?
Right. Thank you. David, over to you. You and Phil had developed your hypotheses, and then you tested each of your model based off of what China was doing as well as indicators. So of these six models, which ones did you find best explains China's behavior and its nuclear modernization?
We found that three of the models had the strongest support, and I would highlight two in particular. So the first that Phil just alluded to was the secure second strike model. And so again, this is one that represents the greatest continuity in China's historic approach to nuclear weapons, and is one that focuses on ensuring the survivability of the strategic deterrent against adversary capabilities or policies which might be viewed as threatening to undermine it. The second model that we found significant support for is the nuclear shield. As Phil said, this is a stronger version of the secure second strike model, and it's one that would attempt to use nuclear weapons to not only deter and respond to nuclear strikes, but also to potentially deter intervention or escalation by an adversary in an otherwise conventional conflict. So it's sort of taking the nuclear shadow and trying to cast it on other forms of intervention, and it views nuclear weapons as more effective at deterring not only nuclear threats from an adversary. The third model that we found strong support for was the great power status model, this idea that China is developing a large, technologically advanced nuclear force in order to distinguish it from the other nuclear powers and in order to compare itself favorably to the nuclear superpowers such as the United States and Russia. And the way that we adjudicated between these, really, it came in two steps. So in the first step, we thought about, for each of these different models and each of these explanations, what are the nuclear forces that would emerge from them? And we looked at the nuclear forces across three different categories. Nuclear force structure, what is the size, the composition of the nuclear forces? Second, operational practices, how does China operate these forces? And then third are the supporting elements. So what is the infrastructure that goes? We found these three models, the secure second strike, nuclear shield, and great power status models, were the most compelling. And the way that we adjudicated between these different models was to try to think about what are different observable indicators, both of the nuclear forces that would emerge from these different competing models, but also of the nuclear policies and practices that would go into supporting them. And so to take an illustrative example, something like force transparency would vary significantly depending on what model is at play. In a secure second strike model, you would imagine that China would have very low force transparency in order to mask the number, the location, the types of nuclear weapons to better protect them from a potential disarming first strike from an adversary. But by contrast, you would expect things such as the great power status model, perhaps the nuclear superiority models, to feature higher levels of force transparency, because if your goal is to burnish China's status and prestige through showcasing its nuclear forces, their size, and their technological sophistication, then you need to show that off both to domestic and international audiences. So we thought about what are indicators that are clearly linked to the underlying logic of each model. What are indicators that are competing, so they help us to differentiate between the models? And what are indicators that hopefully are leading, so they help us to explain not just past decisions in China's nuclear force development, but to predict where might China's nuclear forces go in the future?
Thank you, David. Another topic that I want to touch on are changes in China's nuclear policy or doctrine. As we know, China has long claimed it is committed to a policy of no first use. Could you share with us what your report found in terms of Chinese nuclear policy changes? I know we've talked about changes in China's nuclear force structure and operational practices, but what is happening on the policy side?
at a formal level, the answer is not much, because China hasn't officially changed its policy, nor has it acknowledged the nuclear buildup. But let me delve into that a little bit. So China's nuclear policy from their first nuclear weapons test has historically emphasized the concept of no first use, that they'll only use nuclear weapons in response to a nuclear attack. And that was a very good, useful political statement to have. But for the PLA, they worried that this might make its small nuclear deterrent vulnerable. What if an adversary attacks using only advanced conventional precision munitions? What if an adversary has missile defenses that can intercept China's few ICBMs? That might not be a nuclear attack, but it could put China's nuclear deterrent at risk, and no first use would make it very hard for China to respond. And so I think we've seen historically PLA efforts to try to create some ambiguity there about whether an attack on Chinese nuclear forces with conventional means should actually be considered a nuclear attack so that no first use doesn't apply. And they've also talked in military writings about lowering the threshold for nuclear response in some extreme circumstances. Every time the PLA has tried to raise these issues and get civilians to think about them, the civilians have responded by shutting down the military debate and reaffirming no first use. Now, the other thing that's going on, perhaps, is a Chinese shift toward a launch on warning doctrine. Now, what we mean by launch on warning is if an adversary's nuclear attack is already underway, that constitutes an attack. That is an adversary first use, even if the warheads on the missiles haven't landed yet or gone off. That's one way of thinking about it. If you have a launch on warning doctrine, once the adversary attacks, you can go ahead and shoot back, even if their warheads haven't gone off yet. And the PLA talks about this as what they call an early warning counterstrike. Now, for a long time, China didn't have the capabilities to do this. They didn't have satellites to detect an adversary's ICBM launches. They didn't have the long-range radars to track the missiles and see if they're coming toward China. And they didn't have their own nuclear forces on alert with warheads mated to missiles and ready to respond really rapidly. So this was more of a theoretical concept rather than a real possibility. But what we've seen within the last couple of years is they've added all of those necessary pieces. So they now operate launch detection satellites that can detect U.S. ICBM launches. They have a network of missile tracking radars. And they've started, as David said, to put some of their ICBM units on regular alert. That raises the question about whether they are going to shift to a launch on warning doctrine. I think we find that, or at least I personally find that, somewhat disturbing because it compresses the timelines for decisions about whether to use nuclear weapons. The adversary's missiles are on the way. You have to make a decision about whether to shoot before they land. So that really compresses your decision time. It increases the risk of making mistakes if you are playing the training tape rather than actually getting the live feed from the radars. And yes, that's something that has happened. And it also increases the risk of accidental or unauthorized launch because you have to have ICBMs on alert, ready to launch at short notice. That probably means you have to pre-delegate this authority to the PLA. So I think U.S. government sources see China as moving toward a launch on warning doctrine. I personally am not entirely convinced about that, partly because I think China's civilian leaders want to retain control over the decision to use nuclear weapons. That's an existential decision for the country. And I think they will be very reluctant to delegate that decision to the PLA. And we don't have evidence that they have all the communications lines, the ability to go to Xi Jinping and get a rapid decision in a crisis in time to use a launch on warning.
Speaking of Chinese civilian leaders trying to control its nuclear forces, we recently saw this summer that China removed its top rocket force commanders. Does this speak to what you're saying, Phil, Beijing's concern over controlling its nuclear forces and the quality of current PLA leaders responsible for China's nuclear arsenal?
What's happened with the Rocket Force leadership is very unusual, because this is the commander and political commissar that Xi Jinping put in place there. So he's already looked at them and vetted them and approved them for those senior positions. And now he's taking another look and deciding that they're not suitable. And not only are they not suitable, that their deputies are not suitable. So at the end of the day, he had to go outside the Rocket Force entirely to get a new commander who was a naval officer and a political commissar who was an Air Force officer. And that shows a serious lack of trust of the Rocket Force leadership. Now, it's still not quite clear whether this was a corruption issue, and that's why the commanders were replaced, or whether it's some deeper issue of political reliability. I just don't think we know enough to be able to reach a firm judgment on this at this point in time. But it seems to be a problem that is throughout the Rocket Force, and that's why they had to go outside to get new leadership. Now, this may relate to the launch on warning question, because if Xi Jinping and the civilians are thinking about shifting to a launch on warning doctrine, and if that's going to require some delegation of authority to the PLA Rocket Force, well, then you might take a good hard look at their political reliability and whether you can trust them to have control of nuclear forces. And so it's possible these things interacted, that because of the contemplating a launch on warning shift, they took a good hard look at the PLA Rocket Force leadership and they didn't like what they found. Hence the decision to remove the leadership and look to other services for new leaders, which again is very unusual in the modern PLA to do that. So I don't think we know all of the story, but that's one way that concerns about launch on warning might have interacted with the decision to change the leadership.
Another question I have relates to your theater deterrence model. One of the sentences in your report is, a decision to deploy low-yield or tactical nuclear forces would signal a significant shift in Chinese thinking about the military and political utility of these weapons. Is China pursuing tactical nuclear weapons, and why is deploying them so significant?
Well, clearly they did develop tactical nuclear weapons and a neutron bomb in the past. They developed and tested them, but they never actually deployed them with the PLA or developed the doctrine and the operational capabilities focused on fighting a limited nuclear war. PLA discussed and debated this a lot, but ultimately the Chinese civilian leaders did not authorize this. And we think this is because they believe that nuclear war and nuclear escalation is very, very difficult to control. Once you break the nuclear threshold, you're headed toward possible strategic weapons use and the end of the country as a whole. That idea that you can't control nuclear escalation, or it's very hard to do that, really inhibited this. What I think we're seeing now are PLA writings that talk about possible U.S. use of low-yield or tactical nuclear weapons in a Taiwan contingency, and an argument that China needs to have its own low-yield and tactical nuclear capabilities in order to deter U.S. use. And this is how the debate goes in the United States sometimes. We worry that if North Korea used a very low-yield warhead and all of our warheads are high-yield, it wouldn't be credible to respond to a low-yield warhead with a high-yield one. So that capability gap produces a credibility gap, which leads to a deterrence gap. And what we see are Chinese analysts making that same kind of argument, that the best way to deal with this is for China to build and deploy its own low-yield and tactical nuclear weapons capabilities as a deterrent. But once you do that, it also has the potential to turn into an offensive capability. And for the deterrent to be credible, it's not enough just to have a couple tactical nukes somewhere. You need delivery systems. You need to train and practice with them. You need a doctrine about how you're going to employ them. And that would be a very significant shift. I worry about that. It would require a shift in thinking about what's the value of nuclear weapons, what's their military value, and it would require significant shifts in operational practices and training. We don't see that so far, but if we do see it, it would be a very, very significant shift, and in my view, a pretty dangerous one, because that gets to the point where you have military forces facing off against each other with tactical nuclear weapons and potentially thinking about using them early in a conflict rather than as a last resort. That's a much more dangerous world in my mind.
And Bonnie, if I can just add to that, one of the ways that ongoing expansion and modernization may be affecting the likelihood of China deploying these kinds of systems is now that China has much more accurate theater nuclear capable delivery systems, it makes the possibility of using lower yield warhead designs more feasible. So in the past, if you had a very inaccurate missile, you need a large yield warhead in order to still disable or destroy the target, even if the missile goes off course. But today, China has more accurate missiles. It's always very fraught to try to estimate a missile's accuracy using open sources and from a distance. But we know that these missiles are more accurate, not only from unclassified U.S. reports, but also because these missiles are often deployed with conventional armaments, which by their necessity demand a greater accuracy. And so this is one way that changes in China's nuclear hardware are reducing the technical constraints on its operational practices. In the past, we could have greater confidence that China not only did not field these capabilities, but likely wouldn't field them because it wouldn't make much sense technically. But today, this is one way that these technical constraints are falling to the side and removing some of the inherent credibility that comes with China's declaratory nuclear policy.
So before, they just couldn't do those things because they didn't have the capability. Now they do have increasingly the technical capability, and that might mean that their policy could shift relatively rapidly. And so that makes the whole situation a little more unstable, a little more unpredictable, and that's challenging for trying to create stability in U.S.-China relations, as well as at the nuclear level.
Phil, your last point is a good segue to a final set of questions I have for both of you. As we look at China's nuclear expansion, what are the implications of China's nuclear modernization for the United States? And what does China's nuclear efforts mean in terms of what the United States should be prepared for on the security front, including in the event of a regional or Taiwan contingency?
Phil and I have another piece that we've co-authored that looks at this very set of questions. So first, I think the nuclear expansion means that China will be less susceptible to nuclear threats and intimidation by the United States. As Phil alluded to earlier, Chinese strategists have often been concerned that in a military conflict, it would be the U.S. that would escalate to nuclear use first in order to compensate for a potential conventional inferiority against a modernizing PLA. But the nuclear expansion, to the extent that it makes China's nuclear forces more survivable, more capable, and that it makes the survivability and capability more obvious to U.S. decision makers, may bolster China's resolve, particularly in the face of any potential nuclear threats or intimidation. The second implication is that it likely increases the relevance of the conventional balance of forces. So this, again, feeds into the logic of the nuclear shield model that we discuss in the report, and harkens back to the stability-instability logics that Phil described earlier. And essentially, if there is greater stability at the nuclear level, then that may essentially eliminate the ability to use nuclear weapons and nuclear threats to accomplish your goals in a crisis or a conflict. And it puts greater emphasis on conventional capabilities, which will be more flexible. Third, it likely means that any potential Chinese threats of limited nuclear escalation or retaliation will be inherently more credible. I don't think that we've seen any significant evidence that China plans to use its nuclear weapons in this way, and they've generally been worried about the inability to control nuclear escalation once that threshold has been crossed. But the nuclear buildup, again, lessens the kinds of technical and operational constraints that previously existed when it came to nuclear first use. Fourth and finally, one of the perhaps silver linings of the nuclear expansion is that it may decrease some forms of nuclear escalation risks. the more confident that Chinese officials are in the survivability of the country's nuclear deterrent, the less likely they are to perceive these kinds of use or lose pressures that can encourage nuclear use. And we have Chinese writings discussing how they might lower the nuclear threshold if the strategic nuclear deterrent is perceived to be at risk from precision-guided conventional munitions. But a stronger, a larger, more survivable nuclear force means that China is less likely to experience these kinds of escalation pressures. And it also means that China is more able to preserve the survivability of its strategic deterrent without resorting to flushing nuclear submarines from ports or dispersing mobile missiles to their launch sites, which, even if the intent of those moves is to preserve the survivability of those forces, could be interpreted by U.S. observers as preparations for an actual launch and could be highly escalatory.
So just to make sure, David, what you're saying is it is not clear that as China expands its nuclear arsenal, that China is more likely to use nuclear weapons. Instead, there could be incentives on China's end in terms of less use or lose pressure on nuclear weapons. This could, in some cases, decrease PRC incentives to actually use nuclear weapons.
We might think of the modernization as expanding the possibility that China could engage in deliberate nuclear escalation. So providing more capabilities to use its nuclear weapons for deterrence or coercive advantage in a crisis or a conflict. Again, removing the past technical constraints that existed on the forces. But it might also decrease the risks of inadvertent escalation by providing those decision makers greater confidence that the strategic deterrent can't simply be wiped out by a U.S. counterforce strike, whether nuclear or conventional.
What does China's nuclear expansion mean for arms control negotiations? Would we see more or less PRC willingness to enter into these negotiations as its nuclear force expands?
This may be another area where the modernization has perhaps a silver lining. So in the past, Chinese officials have resisted efforts to enlist China's participation in arms control agreements by referencing the asymmetry that existed between U.S. and Chinese nuclear forces, and also by highlighting the supposed vulnerability of China's own forces. Arms control agreements were seen as a way to force China to provide greater information about its nuclear forces, information that could be used to support a disarming strike against China. And it was also viewed as a way to cap China's nuclear forces and lock China into a permanent state of inferiority. But if the nuclear expansion and the buildup means that China's nuclear forces will more closely approximate the size and sophistication of U.S. forces, then those reasons fall to the wayside, both in terms of the logic they provide to Chinese decision-making, but also as an excuse that Chinese officials can use in their discussions with their American counterparts. The evidence that we find in the study supporting great power status drivers influencing China's nuclear force development also suggests that attempts to enlist Chinese participation in arms control agreements might cater to those great power status desires. So emphasizing that nuclear arms control agreements are something that powerful states do, that responsible states do, and that great power states do, which distinguishes them from the other nuclear powers. And maybe emphasizing some of these dynamics with Chinese officials could, on the margins, increase the ability to enlist Chinese participation.
I think David's given the optimistic spin that this nuclear expansion takes away some of the traditional Chinese excuses. And I think he's correct, and I agree that there's the potential to try to bring China to the table with the United States and Russia as an equal and leverage the status benefits from that to try to get into a real nuclear arms reduction process. That said, I think the prospects are pretty grim because there's a number of obstacles that I think are becoming more problematic. So one of those is U.S.-China relations, the deterioration in relations decreases trust and makes it hard to get to an arms control agreement. There are imbalances just within Asia. So even if China and the U.S. are more on an equal playing field, China faces Japan and the ROC, which are less powerful states that don't have nuclear weapons. North Korea is part of a challenge for nuclear arms control, and it's way inferior to the U.S. So if you're thinking about arms control, those imbalances in Asia are a problem. I think you see that the United States is starting to worry about the potential for China-Russia strategic cooperation and nuclear cooperation. This is sometimes called the three-body problem, but in the most recent nuclear posture review, that's one of the concerns. Does the U.S. have to be worried about China and Russia working together strategically, including on nuclear issues? And if that's the case, we move from a position where all three states might have roughly equal nuclear arsenals to one where you worry about it being two versus one. And then finally, I think just more generally, there is starting to be more interaction between conventional and nuclear forces, partly because missile defenses apply to both of those. And there's a growing importance of the space and cyber domains, both to support nuclear forces, but also to enable conventional warfighting as well. So the types of things that you would have to talk about and deal with in strategic arms control, I think, have gotten more complicated and more challenging. So I'm fairly pessimistic about what the prospects are. What can we do? I think there's hope for increased transparency to limit arms races. And that's one of the things that kind of comes out of our study, that if status is a motivation for China, well, you kind of have to talk about your forces in order to get that status. So that may support greater transparency. There's a need to improve crisis communications, especially military crisis communications. It is kind of worrisome that we haven't been able to use regular military-to-military meetings between the U.S. and China for about a year and a half. And when we've tried to use the defense telephone link, the hotline, to talk to the PLA, often, usually, they've refused to pick up the line and talk. So I would like to see more there. I would like to see a dialogue on operational practices and how that relates to crisis stability. Some of the things that David talked about, what are you going to do in a crisis? Are you going to flush your nuclear forces to the field? Are you going to deploy your nuclear SSBNs? Should that be seen as a defensive move or an offensive move? And often it's ambiguous. I think we could have a dialogue about what things would be alarming and what things should be expected. And then finally, it's worth exploring whether there's any possibility for confidence-building measures. It is worth noting that China and Russia have an advance launch notification mechanism. Perhaps that's something that the U.S. and China could negotiate. So you would give warning of a space launch or a missile launch ahead of time so the other side knows what to expect and doesn't mistakenly interpret it as a missile attack. So those are opportunities, but I think on the whole, the prospects for serious progress in arms control are fairly dim.
We need to wrap this up relatively shortly, but one final question. Phil, you mentioned the possibility of China, Russia working together on nuclear issues and strategically. Did the two of you find any strong evidence of this happening right now?
I don't think we have strong evidence of strategic cooperation between China and Russia. The closest we have to that are China-Russia command post exercises that looked at scenarios involving strategic missile launches. And the two countries worked together to figure out how to track them, characterize them, and decide what to do. That happened twice. It was just a command post exercise. However, the Russians have said they're willing to advise and consult with China as it tries to build a missile launch detection system. That's something the Russians have had for decades. China's just building their system. So they're talking about that piece of it. But that's a long way from thinking about coordinated nuclear attacks or anything along those lines. My own reading of the China-Russia relations is that they cooperate together to limit U.S. power, but there's still a lot of underlying mutual suspicions on both sides. Russia does worry about China as a long-term threat when you go out decades. That's one of the things that changed. Russia used to be the stronger power. Now China's stronger than Russia. And that creates a lot of concern in Moscow about what might happen for the future. That's especially true now when Russia is bogged down in the war in Ukraine and suffering various economic consequences and military losses. That makes them more dependent on China. And I think that's just not a comfortable position for Russia to be in. But nevertheless, you can understand U.S. military planners look at the worst case scenario. And that is the worst case scenario. If China and Russia do have a close strategic relationship and team up against the United States, I just don't think it's very likely, though.
Yeah, I would add to that several features of the nuclear practices of both China and Russia, which I think will introduce additional obstacles to that kind of very deep cooperation. So one is there's still a significant asymmetry in the size and the composition of Chinese and Russian nuclear forces, which could introduce different ways of thinking about how to posture them. The second is we've seen a much greater concern from Chinese actors about the prospects of nuclear escalation in Ukraine. And Chinese observers have issued statements to that effect, warning about the possibility of nuclear escalation, which again goes back to this notion that Chinese actors believe that nuclear escalation can't be controlled once you cross that threshold, which appears to be different from how Russian strategists may think about nuclear escalation. The last one is looking at the history of nuclear cooperation between the United States and its own allies. I think that even very close U.S. allies that have hosted U.S. combat forces for decades still may not feature the kind of deep nuclear cooperation that sometimes people imagine might come between China and Russia. And of course, Russia and China, while military cooperation is increasing, there's a significant gap between the level of military cooperation that's featured between Beijing and Moscow and, say, between Washington and its various allies around the globe. And I think that suggests some caution about predicting that kind of nuclear cooperation.
Just on that point, that's a project that we at National Defense University are taking on, trying to come up with a methodology to assess the military significance of China-Russia military exercises and also the political signaling value of it. I think we agree with David's bottom line. The military exercises are not all that significant, although they're getting more significant since about 2014, but it's a lot less significant than a major U.S.-NATO exercise or a major U.S. exercise with South Korea that have a lot more significant military training going on and military activities going on.
Great. Thank you so much, David, and thank you so much, Phil. We could have continued this conversation for another hour on the host of issues we discuss, whether it's China's nuclear development or China-Russia nuclear relations. I want to thank both of you again for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Bonnie. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having us, Bonnie. Appreciate it.